The best thing I can say about him is he's really a good AA. And he's helped a lot of people. And I've been a part of a lot of people's sobriety up here in his sharing. And he's got a good program. And I'm going to let his sponsor come up and say a word or two about him, too. Come on, BC.
I'm B.C. Miller, an alcoholic and drug addict. And because this program works, I haven't found necessary to take a drink or do any drugs since May of 1984. For that, I'm truly grateful. And I'm sure Stevie's got plenty to say. Anything that I would say would probably be, knowing me, be self-serving. So I'm going to let Stevie go right now.
Hello, everybody. I'm Stevie. I'm an alcoholic and an addict. And I, too, am nervous. I've been sober today by the grace of God, and that's the only way I know of. Everything I've done got me here. I know that a lot of what got me here was also the grace of God, because I couldn't have needed the questions or had the questions, I don't think, that I try to find out the answers to these days without the grace of God. I started off my drinking and using career, oh, I guess early 60s, when I was somewhere around 7 or 8 years old. Grew up in an alcoholic family. My father was an alcoholic, and even though I saw the problems that alcohol caused in our family, I still found it attractive for some reason. I don't know what that was. I thought I was missing something. I was always a kid who was afraid I was going to miss something. Somewhere along the line, I started trying to find out why my father would go back and continue to drink, even though every time he did, I saw what happened, which was big fights, you know, violence. And we were always real scared of him. But he continued to do it anyway, and I never did understand what that was until one day, a few years later, I realized that I wasn't doing anything any differently other than making a little bit more money and added a few drugs to it, you know. I guess about 7 or 8 years old, I started stealing drinks. Either, well, my parents used to have these 42 parties, and quite a few people would come over, and they'd be having their Tom Collins or whatever, you know. And when somebody wasn't looking, I'd take one of the drinks and run in the kitchen, you know, and make them a new one. And refresh their drink, you know. It's just that I would refresh my memory about what it tasted like a lot of the time, you know. I never really thought that it tasted very good or anything. And then one day I tried to make myself a drink out of my dad's bourbon that was in the freezer. It didn't taste very good either. I guess it was the wrong brand or something. I don't know. But somewhere along the line, I started finding that attractive somehow. About the same time, ear, nose, and throat doctor, who it was general practice with him when you went in for him to take a look up your nose, he would squirt you full of what I later found out was a strong solution of liquid cocaine. And I never really knew why my face was numb when I left there and why I felt a little different, but I later on found out that I didn't know how to breathe without the stuff, you know, because it was in a nose spray he gave me. The first bottle said use, you know, once every 24 hours. The second bottle said use 2 or 3 sprays every 12 hours, and the next one said use as needed. And I did, but I guess as I was going into junior high was when I really started trying to drink. We'd moved to Graham, Texas, and I really didn't want to go at all. I'd gotten in the first band that I really wanted to be in and was excited about it, and we had to move, and I had to give up everything, you know, including my way. We got to Graham, and My parents had told me we were going to be there for about 6 weeks. And that was about 6 weeks into the 6 months that we stayed there. While I was going to school there, actually the first day I went to school there in Graham, Texas, just to show you what kind of, how much I liked it, I got kicked out of school 3 times the first day. And I didn't even do anything. You know, I just went to school and they didn't like how my belt was, or they didn't like how my hair was cut twice, you know. And I real quick found this guy that sold Alka-Seltzer bottles full of sour mash. And continued to sign him every day, you know. Even though I didn't like how it tasted or anything, it just kind of helped me smooth along, you know. Because there wasn't anything that I really wanted there. I'd get beat up all the time. And there wasn't anybody to play any music with. And we stayed there for about 6 months, and finally I just told my parents that I wasn't going back to school anymore. And that ended up being about the same time we moved back to Dallas. And back to Dallas for me was, I didn't realize what I was doing at the time, but really all I really was doing here at the time was, well, I was trying to play music and everything, but the main thing I was doing was hanging out with the kids down the street. And, what they did all the time was see how they could get high this way or that way, you know. And I thought that, well, all I was doing was just trying to be in with the people, you know, with these kids. And what I was really doing was learning how to get high and stay high all the time and run away from what was going on, which was, I guess what was going on really was that, you know, people grow up and they learn things about living life and grow. That never dawned on me. I just thought you just kind of went from day to day and you got older and then things happened and you graduate and, or quit school or whatever. At any rate, I just learned how to bag glue and how to figure out this pill was this kind and this was that kind, and if you hit real hard on this joint, you might get a buzz. Usually I was scared to though, at the time. The thing was, is that was the only thing I knew how to do. The only thing I knew how to do was just try to get by every day. I wasn't really learning anything about living life. There was really no information at home because I couldn't, it was pretty violent in my house. I couldn't go and ask my dad about things. I couldn't go ask my dad about school or about girls or about anything because it was pretty much you're supposed to know that stuff on your own. Or just leave me alone. Is that your stuff? Get it out of the room, you know? So I just continued to try to find out things from the kids down the street. And that wasn't the way to really go. I didn't know that. What I did keep learning, though, was about bands. And not to blame my drinking or anything on bands, but I sure learned a lot about it there. Because that was, and still is, unfortunately, in a lot of places, that's where a lot of the myth about it's real neat to get high or real cool to get high. That's where I learned a lot of it. Because a lot of the people I really looked up to really knew how to drink and really knew how to get high. And along with every time I would get in a better band, it seemed like there were better drugs, better brand of a gin or whatever, you know. And I always thought I had to keep up. I just thought I had to keep up. Why that was, I don't know. I would see someone who I really cared about and know that they... This is a pattern that's gone on most of my life, and I still don't understand why it's attractive to me or has been. I would see someone who I really cared and loved, you know, cared for and loved, and that they couldn't do anything unless they... were shooting something, and I would see that it would be literally killing them, and that would be a good reason for me to try it. I don't know. I don't understand that. But that's a pattern that I developed. I saw it with my father. I saw it with very close friends, and I've seen it with people who are no longer alive, you know. I'm glad to say that I'm not doing that anymore. Because there was a stage in my life where I got to experimenting. Not like I thought experimenting was in the first place, but what happens to you if you do this much, you know? There was a time in my life when a normal day would be to pull out whatever I could get my hands on and do it all at once. It wasn't do it till it was gone. It was do it all right then. And it would be enough to kill somebody. But for some reason, that was what I did. And I would sit there and go, well, this is what happens, and stay alive somehow. And I got it in my head that that was a, I don't know, somewhere along the line I got this verse, or it's not even a verse, it's just something in the Bible where in the last days people will be trying to kill themselves and can't. And that's what I thought I was doing, I think. For some reason I thought I couldn't die. I guess that's that Superman deal that we did. Through the years, all this progressed and I just got to where everything I was doing was on a road to killing me. The only thing that I was doing that wasn't destructive was trying to play music. But that was really quickly taking a back seat to everything else. I still cared about someday finding something that meant something to me inside and with another person or with other people. I still cared about growing somehow. But bit by bit, all of that was going somewhere in the past where I couldn't reach it anymore. Yeah. I went and tried to find out how many crown royals I could get, you know. And there's never enough. I learned that a long time ago. There's never enough dope and there's never enough to drink. There's either too much or not enough. You know, there's never just enough. But I went and tried anyway. And went back and I felt guilty already. I'm real good at the guilt. You know, I went straight back to the seat and sat down next to her. And, you know, I'm like, well, this is not what I did, you know. I kind of knew that, you know. And, anyway, we went back, we landed and I went to a hotel room, stayed there till the next day, went into treatment. I didn't expect to find out in treatment that that was one of the coolest places I'd ever been. But that's what I found out. It wasn't, what I thought it was going to be at all. I went through the regular stuff, you know, what if they find out I'm here, or who's day, and, you know. And I don't want to be here and all, you know, all that stuff. But once I started paying attention to what was going on in treatment, to the recovery, it's been something that I've really wanted ever since. Not always been real good at sticking to a good, strong program. But at least I know that when I'm able to find those steps in my life, that it works. And it's really the only thing that does. Because anything else I'm doing is just trying to fix something else up to look the way I want it to look, or to be the way I want it to be, instead of working my way into living life. Well, what I found in treatment was the same thing that I find in a meeting when I'm in the right place. In my heart at a meeting, and that's a bunch of people trying to help each other live life and grow in it. It's always been something that I've wanted to know about. And it's always been something that I've wanted to do. It's not always been something that I've done. Sometimes I don't even know what grow means, but it's something that I find once in a while I find growth. And then I feel like me. If that's not where I'm at, then I feel like a shell with a bunch of static going on. That's really the way I feel. In the program of AA, I found the only real lasting happiness that I've ever had. And it lasts whether I can really reach it or not. I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but I know that it's there even though I can't always feel it. Because I know it's not out of something that I've made or bought or conned somebody out of. It's something that's bound to be real. I see it when I see other people come out of a real hard place to be into a more comfortable place with themselves. I know that must be growth. It's not just a new pair of boots or something, you know. I don't know, the hardest things that I've learned so far, I guess, is probably letting go of my own way, getting my own way, other people acting the way that I think they should act, or looking the way that I think they should look. I'm not out of that yet. It's just, that's my way, you know. My way is not the right way necessarily at all. And it's hard to admit that. It's hard to admit that I don't know it all. But that's what I used to think. I used to think that if it wasn't done my way, that it was completely wrong and it couldn't be anything close to right because you just didn't know. I don't know, sometimes I find out that it's real comfortable not knowing everything, you know. Not knowing anything, in fact. It's funny, I'm real uncomfortable saying that right now, but that's the truth. I don't know, I just know that when I come to meetings, when I take the time to pray and to listen and to take a look at myself and try to change, that I grow. And when I try to offer that to someone else, I feel better. And that I don't have any need to drink or to take any drugs. And if that's what this program does, if that's all it does, then it's helped me a whole lot. Because that's all I used to know. Was drinking and using drugs. It's really all I knew. Because I didn't know how I felt. I still don't always know how I feel. A lot of times I still find myself confused about what I think and what I feel. I don't know the difference very often. And that's a scary place to be a lot of times. But slowly, day by day, that's working out. It's working out for the better. It's been about 3.5 years, I guess, close to 3.5 years, since I've had to drink. And it struck me New Year's Eve that to go and do what I had to do New Year's Eve was a lot different this year than I'd noticed it being in the past, you know. A couple of years ago, it was like this. Last year, it was kind of a daze. I was sick, but it was kind of a daze. This year, I was actually happy to be alive. And noticed that I didn't have to be high to be up till 5 in the morning or whatever it was, you know. And that I could look out and realize that I was starting a new year with new things to try to do and new things to try to care about. And one of them was me, and one of them was y'all. And what I do with my life. And commitments. Commitments has been another thing that I've never been very good at in my life. Well, I could get caught up in something. Real good, you know. I could get caught up in the mirror combing my hair, you know. Or whatever. But commitments had not been something that I'd been very good at. Because I was more scared of making a commitment than I was following it through, you know. But I realized that I'm still alive now. And that's an amazing thing to me. When I was 17, I thought I wouldn't make it to 21. When I made it to 21, I thought something's up, you know. You know, what's going on here? When I passed 30, I thought something's wrong. I don't know. I'm just glad to be alive today. You know? Glad to be alive today. I don't know. I don't really have a whole lot to say about anything other than knowing that if I let this program and if I let God do what he's going to do in my life through you or through whatever, that it's a whole lot better than I ever could have done it myself before I came to this program. I thank y'all for letting me be here with you. Whether I know what to say about it or not, it means a lot to me. And I thank you, okay?
I just want to break down, but really had nothing prepared at all, but I guess I never really had anything prepared until I tried to accept God into my life and to help me share what I've experienced through AA. And it's because of AA that I'm sober today. It's because of a power greater than me that kept me from having a drink. And I really feel this power even more so than ever before in my life. I started working with Stevie in 85. Sometimes I can't remember when exactly because we were really partying hard at the time. Stevie was always the kind of person who, even then, was giving and was concerned about you, how you felt. If you were being taken care of, and he did see that we were being taken care of, and always just really taking care of you in any way, shape, or form. I can relate to some ideas right now that I decided to hit my head. I'd have to travel with him sometimes to go to various meetings or recording dates or studio, that sort of thing. It would be just me and him. And we'd get to the airport, and we'd say hi, and the first thing that came to his head was, where are you sitting? And I go, well, I'm on row 30B or something like that. And he goes, what? 30B, hold on a second. And he'd look at here with me, and kind of like, said, come on over here. And we go over to the airline reception place, and he'd want to get a seat with me next to him. He'd be like, you know, first class or something like that. He didn't book all the things, so he got to by what being booked, but he wanted me to sit next to him. And we get there, and there wouldn't be a seat available, and I go, see, it's okay, don't worry, I'm fine, you know, I'm back here if you need me, you know, it'll be okay. And we'd be on the plane, and everybody'd be sitting down, they'd stood at the same place, sit down, we can't taxi until everybody seated down, and just at that point, I hear here come Luke Martinez, please come to the front. And, I kind of like to shake my head, you know, and I go up, and then there's CUA looking back at me, smiling, kind of doing like that, yeah. And I'd be somewhere behind him or next to him or something like that, and I go, see me or something else. And you go, all right. And that's taking care of somebody, you know. I mean, he always wanted to be close to somebody, and he did that on several occasions, you know. I always thought that was really neat, you know, and that sometimes we just all couldn't sit, you know, in first class. But everywhere we went, everywhere we worked at, he was like that. He never really introduced me as his guitar tech. I took care of all of his CDs, took care of all his guitars. I helped him set up his gear. I took care of all that. That was my job. And when it came to introducing me, he would introduce me as, this is my friend, Renee. And it wasn't like this is my hired hand or help or anything like that, you know. That's the kind of guy he was, you know. And I always thought that was just really neat, you know. To be sitting there with him at the airport, and people come up asking for autographs. And it's kind of hard. I don't know how you feel about it, but to me it was still hard. Always people want to see him. They want to have his autograph, and I kind of want to get out of the way, get a protective of him, okay, just some Lulu out there, you know, and he'd always bring me into the picture, introduce me, you know, and he does my guitars, this is Renee, does my guitars, takes care of me, and these people go, oh, wow, this is Renee Martinez, blah, 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 and I feel kind of like, oh, man, you know, this is Stevie's deal, it's not mine, but he kept reassuring me all the time, you're just going to have to get used to it, right? And it was very hard to get used to it, you know. It was hard to run on stage with Stevie Ray and help him when a guitar string would break or his strap would fall. You know, I would have to run out there and change guitars or help him with his strap, you know. And sometimes it worked real good and sometimes it looked like a big screw up on stage, you know. But it was okay. It was his stage, and later come to realize it was really our stage, you know. And but he was always giving, you know, and what I'm trying to lead to is that when we got into recovery, it was hard to adjust to some things. He came into the program before I did. I followed later on my sobriety date is January 1st, 87. It happened to be January 1st. You know, it wasn't a New Year's resolution or anything like that. You know, it was just one of those things where it was time to do something, you know. And, but then I thought too, well, that's a good day. I can remember that, you know. So it wasn't too hard, you know, and, it was hard. It was hard not to have a drink at first, you know. And I went through some days, and it was pretty rough, you know. And I kept trying to do this deal about, came to believe that a power could take care of me, you know. And it worked, you know. And we came to have meetings on our own on the road. We had meetings wherever we could at any different place, you know, different parts of the world. And we decided we'd have meetings on our own, so we formed our own group. And that helped a whole lot. There were times in early sobriety that we were having difficulty with alcohol and drugs. It was all around us all the time, you know. And since we couldn't make everybody quit drinking, you know, it was their own deal. They had to do it on their own. I saw that. I figured that was something they would have to do, but it was hard. Stevie, on the other hand, would see maybe one or two of us having difficulty with that and was ready to do jurisdiction, you know, that sort of thing. And we talked about that too. And it's because of AA and what principles and what steps that we had that we had to decide that, you know, these people got to decide on their own. You know, we have our own group. We have a problem. Come talk to each other. Call an alcoholic or another alcoholic or talk to your sponsors and so forth, you know. Keeping the AA tradition going as best as we knew how, you know. Early in sobriety, I mean, you know, it turned out to be there were four of us, you know, with a few months, 6 months or whatever sobriety, you know, amongst us, you know, and we're all trying to help each other out, you know, and it was hard, you know. I know he talked many, many times to his sponsor, and I did as much as I could. I talked with my friend who was on a crew who happened to be in AA. And we talked a lot, and he was a real pain in the butt, you know, he was sick, you know, and this guy, you know, if God put anybody into my life to keep me straight, then he put him into my life, you know, this guy was a screaming, cussing, yell at you for no reason whatsoever, you know, and you did this and you did that, you know, and boy, do I want to drink, and I'm not fit, I'm tired of it, and I'm going to get drunk. And just, you know, it had me think all over again and think, well, what am I going to do here, you know? And it's because AA again, you know, and the power of greater than me that we were able to sit down and we were all able to talk things over and the drink problem was literally going away and then finally it was okay, you know? That's what we all shared together. That's what Steve really wanted to share with everybody. And he went to even a greater extreme, you know? He literally went up on the microphone and talked to everybody, you know, during these shows, you know, while in sobriety. And I thought that was just, you know, that was just something else, you know. I mean, anonymity came to my head, you know, all these things, you know. But this is what he wanted to do, you know. He wanted to share the message. He wanted to get it across, you know, that somewhere along the line, you know, maybe a seed will be planted, you know. And that's what you all did to me. You all gave me more seeds to grow with, you know. I come here, you know, these seeds, you know, you gave me so much, you know. And you know, we tried to help each other, you know, trying to cure the drink problem, you know, the alcoholics, you know. And it's, you never stop, you know. This went on for a long, long, long time. I'm going to say a long time, like about a year. You know, we were into sobriety, you know, all of us. And out of nowhere, one of our guys came back to the hotel, and we happened to run into each other, and he was talking to someone who happened to go to AA and decided to straighten out his life. And it was hard to know if he's still sober, you know. I had to tell Steve that, you know, and Steve would go, well, he said, you know, it's amazing. The power of this program, power of God, you know, what I'm trying to say is that he didn't say, I did it. you know, it wasn't me. You know, he said that the message there, the power of God, you know, is getting to the people, you know. And I really thank him for that, you know. That's Stevie Ray, you know. What's the program? I don't think there's a bag, a luggage bag out there big enough to carry all the books that he carried with him when he got on that damn plane. His satchel is just crammed full of books, you know. Every book you can imagine. I have never seen any of these books, I don't think, you know. First time that tells you where I'm at with my program. But he would always have these books, and that's why he sat down next to me, I guess, because at one point, with all the books that he had with him on board, underneath, in front of him, in a library, he would always reach into his coat pocket and pull out a bunch of these. And he'd look over at me and go, "You want one?" And I'd just go, "Wow, this guy here's got more books than anybody." Anyway, I'd go, "Yeah, sure." And I'd grab one. I'd look at the ones that he had. He had about four or five of them. And I'd look at one, and this is one of the ones that he handed over to me. And I said, "I'll take this one here." And he'd look at me, and he'd look at that book, and he'd go, "Which one did you get?" And I'd go, "I've got this one here." And I'd open it up, and I'd start reading it, and before long, he would be over looking with me and waiting for me to say something about what I've read. And I'd go, "Wow, this is real. I can identify with this here." And he would listen. And what I'm trying to say is that, you know, he was open as much as he could. He wanted to hear what other people had to say. He wanted to be hearing messages, you know, from other people. Just as we hear messages when we go to meetings, we listen to other people. You know, I do. I listen to other people and try to get something out. And I do walk away with something, you know, that somebody else has shared with me. And that's like a real, real gift, you know. And for me as an alcoholic, I need that. I need to go home with something on my mind that can just hopefully, you know, interrupt that thought of drinking somewhere down along the line, you know. And it's just for that day. And that's real good, you know. I don't have to worry about tomorrow anymore. I don't have to worry about yesterday. It's just today. And if I go home with that kind of thought, you know, it's a good feeling, you know. And if I need more help over here, the big book's here. And God, of course, is here all the time if I let him. And this is what Steve, for me, was always trying to do, you know, trying to carry the message, you know. And I think he was really hard at work with that. Besides being a good friend, you know, besides meaning so much of him, you know, and besides, I know this is not AA related at all, but being one of the best guitarists in the whole world, being able to work for the best, you know, was just, I don't know how to explain this in words, you know, how it really felt to be able to work for his guitars, you know, and try to do the best that I could for him as far as making it play so easy that he can get out there and play his message or whatever that was guitar-wise, you know, and just feel comfortable enough that after he got through playing a particular solo that he could sit on the microphone and talk to people, feel comfortable, you know. There wasn't a nagging fret or a broken string, you know, or something like that that would bother him. He could kind of go out there, and if I did something like that a little bit, it really helped, you know. He taught me a lot. He engrossed my guitar repair, whatever. You know, I couldn't have worked for any better, I really don't think. You know, he was the best that there was, you know. I miss him so much that I don't know how to explain it in words. Dressing room. I walked into his dressing room that night, and to ask him about gear that we were going to be taking to Europe the following week. And there he was, sitting on the couch with a real frustrated look on his face, so I'm trying to sew this patch on his leather jacket. And, you know, he didn't go out of his way to ask anybody to do this thing. And I saw him, and he looked at me like I thought I had done something wrong, you know. And then I noticed what was going on, and I said, "Steve, what are you doing?" And he said, "I'm sewing this leather patch on my jacket. It's coming off, you know." And I said, well, I want to go over this gear list with you here. And then I told him, "Please leave me alone. I'll take care of it." I said, "Your fingers were a little sore because you hadn't played in about a month." And I said, "Leave me alone. I'll do it." I said, "You got to play tonight." I said, "You're training with Eric Clapton tonight." And I said, "Just let me handle that, please." And then finally, he's like, "Really?" And I said, "Yeah, it's okay." And he's got a big smile on his face. And I'll never forget that. And I wound up finishing it up, and he was joking with me, and it's just like he was able to go do what he wanted to do, you know, and I like that, you know. And it's just things that I wanted to do, you know. I've taken care of him, and I wanted him to get out there and play as best as he could. He didn't need to be messing with no patch when he wore a jacket, you know. There's a couple more, just one more thing that I did for him, and you know, he was looking for a strap, a leather strap to hold on a cross that had broken, and I went and found something, and he was able to wear it that night, and that smile on the face, you know, just never forget, you know, and there's nothing, no bad feelings of any kind, you know, and it's because of the program of AA, trying to straighten up my life, and trying to keep all these defects, tears out of my way, you know, and it's working, you know, it's slowly but surely working, you know, and I like it, I like being sober, I like it a whole lot, and it's worth it, I can tell you that. I won't take up too much more of your time. I'd like to read something here, something that Stevie gave me. I was celebrating, I don't know how word gets out, but I guess we're all so close together on the road that stuff leaks out. I was 3.5 years of sobriety on this past year for on the road, and I told my buddy about it, and next thing I knew, that Steve would come up to me at the end of the show out of nowhere and said, "Oh, by the way, I've got a little present for you for your 3.5 years. It just, you know, made me choke and go, "Wow, I mean, this guy would even do something like this out of his hard schedule, you know." So what it is, it's just a little thing here, and it talks about world peace. And I'd like to read it to you, and I'll step out of the way here. It says, "Affirming today's statement of truth helps me live in harmony with those near to me, and to send a message of peace to all the people of the world. Through prayer, I commit my thoughts, my words, my life to the peace of God. I contribute to the well-being of myself and to the well-being of people around the world. I can help to alleviate unrest right where I am or in any area far away. My prayers and affirmations radiate peace that blesses those near and afar. I understand that no matter where in the world I may be, I live and move and have my being in God. This is the truth about me and the truth about others. There is no place in the world where the peace of God is not present. One more, I understand that I can live peacefully in the world and give peace to my world, for I am one of God's creations of love and peace. So thank you. I'm glad to be here. Thank you very much."
That people who don't know him in the way that Renee
first night. He's let some other people in like that, and I'm going to have somebody come up now that I don't think necessarily knew him all that long, but I bet he's got something to say about the time where he didn't know his gene.
Pathways. And after it was over, we rode around, we talked about this deal for a little while. And I said, hey, man, I said, you know what we want you to do? We want you to give us a concert. I said, we're struggling. And I said, man, I really do need some help. He said, I'll help you, man. And he wrote out his agent's name and number. He said, tell him I said we're going to have a concert. And that was it. And I called his agent a few times and was going back and forth. And finally, last week, I talked to the guy Marshall, his agent. Not his real agent. And so we were going to have a date. It looked like it was going to be November or the first part of the year. And then the next thing I know is that he fell out of the sky in an airplane. And it didn't bother to me. I was with the guy one night, you know. But the thing that I want to share with you is that through the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, through the thing that this thing is about, is that, you know, I can remember when I was a drug addict, and I can remember my buddies getting killed on motorcycles. I can remember my buddies getting killed in robberies. I can remember my buddies getting killed in car wrecks. I can remember my buddies getting killed just shot, you know. And we used to be loaded, and I used to think, damn, man, you know, Harvey, man, he was a hell of a guy. And that was it, you know. And I wouldn't think anything about it, you know. And now in sobriety, you know, and the whole weekend that I was gone away on that island, the only thing I think about is just being really wrong. You know, and just for a short period of time, you know, I was touched in a way that kind of just blows me away. You know? And I went to his funeral, and D.C. started reading how it works, and I started crying. And I came to a place where I never could cry before I found this program. Never. I'm telling you, you do not cry where I come from. You do not cry tears, you just don't do it. And I felt proud and honored to be a part of Alcoholics Anonymous during that deal. And I called BC up and told him, I said, BC, I'm going to speak for me, but you made me feel as good as I've ever felt in my entire life at that funeral to be a part of this deal, to be a part of this program called Alcoholics Anonymous. I feel the little guy more that he's gone now than I did when he was alive. I feel him in my house. I feel him in this deal right here.
It's all in the way, and all you can do is just go. You know, it's just, I don't know. Somebody that knew Stevie a long time ago, here, and she's also known Stevie and sobriety, and I think I'll just try to get on out of that and let Linda come on up.
I'm Linda, I'm an alcoholic addict, and I don't know what I'm going to do with this, but I'm going to try my best. I met Stevie when I was 15 and a half years old. And I was living with this girl, and we'd gone down to Austin, and he was playing at the Waterloo. And to say the least, I was in pretty rare form. I was dancing with a pole. And I was rolling around, just bumping and grinding with this pole, and I turned around, and he's looking at me, and we connected that night. And we drove back from Austin, and we took him to go clip some license and dropped him off, and he was still in high school. And it just was a connection right there that lasted quite a long time. We grew up real fast, and we decided we were going to quit school, and we were going to follow his brother to down to Austin, and we did. He went down pretty much before I did, and I followed. And a lot of my memories of Stevie were during those 4 years. And I, of course, was full-blown. I mean, I really believe that I was full-blown from the very moment that I was born. I really do. Stevie, on the other hand, when I heard this, I immediately went into overwhelm of all the memories that I have of him. And he was one of the most generous giving people I ever knew. And he was so sweet. I mean, he was so tender. It was amazing. I never met a guy like this, you know. And he just took me under his wing, and he took care of me. There were many nights that Susie escorted me out of the bars because I could not walk. And he was just really there for me. And we were young and out there, really out there, and we lived all over Austin. I mean, it was one of those deals. The times were hard, you know. Stevie was, he always had his guitar, and he always, behind closed doors, would tell me. And this is something that's really important to me, because he would always tell me that you have to have something to believe in, that you have to have faith. And that has stuck with me for all these years, because this little guy, and he was quite little, well, with us were, I mean, we're just two starting kids out there in the world, you know, trying to do the deal. He had a lot of strength, and I can remember a lot of times where if I had been him, I probably would have given up, you know, and he didn't, he kept going. You know, I think, the more I think about it after he got into his program, is he always had that inner strength that it took. He always had it. He was very special to me and to a lot of people. He was very giving. And he was very humble. See, I knew Stevie at a time when he was selling Coke. We were selling Coke bottles to dinner. And it was, you know, it was called paying your dues, so to speak. You still remember as well. And, you know, you'd walk into the living room and there would be records everywhere. You couldn't even get to the kitchen because everywhere you looked, there was records. There was Jimi Hendrix and there was guitars and everybody was jamming. I mean, I look back on Austin, what I can remember of it, and that's not a whole lot sometimes. I had some blackouts down there. And I think there was a lot of love and there were a lot of people that connected down there. And the neatest thing for me is when I was about 6 months sober, I walked in through the doors of Aquarius. I had started out at Dallas North and I changed. I walked into the doors of Aquarius and I see BC. And I went, oh my God. I didn't have any idea. I turn around and there's Stevie and I went, oh my God. It was the neatest thing I'd ever experienced. And these guys played a very, I don't know if they know it, but they played a very important role in my recovery. Because when I could see them, because I know what they did and what they went through. And when when I walked through these doors and I saw them, I went, my God, if they can do it, I can do it. I mean, it was such a good visual aid for me. I mean, I was going, oh, really, they just don't know what a big part they played in my recovery, just seeing them. And I would come up periodically and see Stevie, and he'd give me a big hug. And one day, we were in the meeting, and he walked up to me. I always kind of remember Stevie as a little boy. He always kind of had this little boy look too. He was really, really a, you know, just a little sweetheart. And he walks up to me and he goes, Glenda, I finally got a divorce. And I says, God, that's great. You know, that really happens a lot around here. It's just, you know, it's just one of those deals. And he was so excited. And his life was changing. And he was really working hard. And it's, I know that Stevie Vaughn, he fought a lot of battles. And he succeeded. You know, he succeeded in the deal. And that is so important to me today, to see someone with the strength and the belief and faith that he had that kept him going. I'm not very good with words sometimes. It's so hard for me to express how I feel about him. But one of the things that I truly regret is that I did not used to make a move to him the way I really wanted to make a move. And this is something that came up for me immediately when I heard about the crash. And, you know, even though I didn't say the words to him, I know in his heart, in my heart, that he knew. You know, you just kind of know those things. And Bill took me over to the casket that day, and he held my hand, and he said, let's make our amends. And I did, and it felt good. And I have some of the most wonderful memories of this man that I just will cherish for the rest of my life. And I know that what he's done out there is really going to pay a lot of people, I hope. I hope a lot of people get really serious about this deal, and if they try it, I hope you give it a day and try another one, because believe me, it is worth it. And I was going to try to think of a funny war story. There was one thing in Austin that I remember about Stevie was that, it was in Dallas, and the Nightcrawlers had formed their little get-together, and Stevie and I were kind of getting into a little argument about me going to California with them. They were flying off to California. We didn't really know if we could afford it. We were at this club, and Stevie gets on stage and has the whole thing, it's my life and I'll do what I want to. And every time Stevie would be playing guitar, he'd be sitting like that. It's my life. I kind of remember that. That was a pretty neat deal. It was real funny. And probably he had to escort me out that night to the car. But, you know, like I'm saying, you know, that took everything it took. It took every lid that we smoked every day to get us here. And I'm just truly grateful that he had the opportunity to experience this deal before he went on to the next place. And I know he's in a good place. I really do know that. And I love him to death, and I love the AA and Aquarius, and I thank you.
I think it's obvious how these people know about Stevie. I'm just the luckiest guy in the world. I got to see this tape, Matt. Before I came over here, and it's a promo tape, and it's a Stevie and Jimmy being interviewed for this album they did together, and hopefully it'll be on TV somewhere, and everybody can see it. But one of the things that has happened to for those guys is that used to be, if there would be a tape, it would be Stevie doing all the talking and Jimmy kind of doing, and doing his hair. He does this with his hair. And on this tape, Jimmy's doing all the talking. And Stevie's just going, and every once in a while you see him go, and Jimmy just keeps all on talking. And you see him look at the camera like, what is this guy doing? Something has happened there, and I won't say exactly what's happened for Jimmy. I'll say it's evident to me what I think's happening for Jimmy. And I know something that happened for Stevie as a result of being as close to him as I got to be, in the position I got to be in. You're walking through the steps of somebody, you really find out some stuff about him, you know. I mean, I knew it all, a lot of it anyway, but, you know, we all got our little secrets. And I just know that when Stevie was young, that he had to go through some stuff that made it hard for him to show how he felt about people. He felt a certain way. He was soft. He was loving. He cared. He was kind. He was soft. But he went through some things over there at his house that made him start closing down. And I know I got to see it happen. It got worse and worse. You know, that was a tough thing that happened to him, meeting the Nightcrawlers, you know. I mean, we were all 6 years older than he was, and we were way off into it, and he was 17 years old, started trying to jump in with us, and it was tough on him, you know. We were 23, 24, and been drinking 5 years heavy, and he just tried to step right in there with us. And what seemed to happen is he started to close down a lot. Renee says that he was still able to show how he cared, and I think he was to a few choice people. And what I saw from my perspective happened to Stevie as a result of being in AA was it was okay for him to let people know how he thought and how he felt, and it was okay for him to let them know in a general way. It was so okay that he would stand up before 15, 20, 40,000 people and talk about his recovery right in front of them in a song that he wrote for one of his dearest friends who had passed away earlier. And, man, that's all the guy had to give, was everything, and that's what he was given. And the program of AA seemed to be what gave it back to him. And I know it's real easy. It's been real easy for me to be way, way sad the last few days. But as a result of some bits and pieces of information that were brought to me over the last few days and things, prayers that were answered for me and for other members of the family, and the feeling that I had the other day at that service, I know that there's a design in living, and it seems to be that there's, I never said this before, but a design in death. There's something going on here, and my part is to take what Stevie gave to me and to try my hardest to keep on giving it. And I would, it's one thing to have gratitude and hold it for yourself, but if we truly have gratitude for what that fella gave us, well then I think that he wouldn't want any more from us than for us to try to keep passing it on. There was a dream that came to the family the day after Stevie was killed, and his brother shared it with me, and in the dream Stevie's voice said, I had a good life, I did what I came to do. Keep up the good work. Keep up the good work. Y'all all keep up the good work.